brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
SoftRep.com, on time, on target. I hope everybody had a great Memorial Day weekend. I saw the piece that you wrote about, you know, having barbecue, and there was actually a police officer who's a veteran who wrote a tweet that went viral that was like, you know, I'm going to celebrate the honor of these guys by barbecuing and having beers. Like, this is what they would have wanted,
yeah.
And enough with the Memorial Day isn't like a day to celebrate.
I agreed with that. I saw Chris Peranto saying the same thing. He was like, say happy Memorial Day to me. I don't care.
Yeah.
You're like, it's cool.
As long as people know.
We're not snowflakes.
Yeah, as long as people know the meaning of it, I think. Like, yes, you should know the difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day, but it is a day, I think, for veterans who served with guys who are lost in combat.
I wrote that article, you know, it's called, I think it's just called It's Okay to Have a Barbecue.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's all these like cringeworthy veterans posts on social media around this time of year. Like, I dread looking at social media around Veterans Day and Memorial Day because of all these self-aggrandizing veterans that are like, oh, look at me. And all this shit like, oh, no, you're not allowed to be happy on Memorial Day. You're supposed to be solemn and sad. And, you know, like, we're all supposed to go to a bar by ourselves and cry into our beer while we get drunk. It's like, no, that is not what any of the guys who died overseas. None of them want that for you. Like, they want you to go spend time with their family. Any one of those guys that died. Well, I shouldn't say anyone. I can't speak for all soldiers we lost. But I'll say personally, like some of the people I knew who were killed in combat, I'm sure they would do anything for another day with their family.
Yeah.
They would absolutely want me to go and spend time with my friends and family, having a beer, having a barbecue. They would be furious with me if they thought I was in a bar getting drunk by myself, just feeling sorry for myself.
Yeah.
Like, they would be furious about that.
So, which is to say that we had a very good time at the Memorial Day Versus and Curses kickoff event, which, you know, a lot of those...
And we were at a bar drinking, but we were not by ourselves, and we were not crying.
And a lot of those poems, though, were pretty dark. And
yeah, yeah.
A lot of it was in that tone of what we're talking about with Memorial Day.
There was fun stuff. That Marine, Dave Rose, he had some pretty funny poems he read, though.
Yeah, yeah. I think there was a good mix-up. I mean, the only thing that I think when I listened back to the last interview was Leo saying that one of the events is going to be at a strip club, right? Like, that's going to be a hard one to pull off, I think.
Hard sell? Or maybe an easy sell?
That's going to be strange. So I want to hear your thoughts on the event. And, you know, this is honestly how I felt. Because I could just say, oh, it was all great. Everybody was awesome. And first of all, I really do recommend that if you're in the area of these upcoming events that you go. But here's how I felt. Not just because he is a friend of mine and he's the guy that we know out of the three veterans who started this. Leo has a particular talent for performance, for like getting up there.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a big difference between performance and just reading a piece, reading a poem. And for, I'll be honest, like the rest of you guys, you went up there, you read some great pieces. Leo is like, has a talent for getting up there and performing, especially for someone who said he's never been to a poetry reading. He went up there, and he was so polished.
Jenkins missed his calling as a beatnik. Like, he totally should have been one of these beatnik art houses where you get the mongos out, the bongos, like, and everyone snaps their fingers up in the air. I totally dig your groove, Daddy-O. But seriously, Jenkins is very talented. When I was up there, and I read an excerpt from my book, and I wasn't kidding, like, those three guys are dudes who have like a mastery of the English language. They are very good at what they do. They're authors. I'm just a writer. Like, I feel like I just write like this happened and then this happened and then this happened. Like, and that's probably a byproduct of both being a novelist and a journalist.
Yeah.
But you know, Jenkins has a particular talent. I mean, he's like an actual artist, you know, the way he's putting this stuff together.
Yeah. And the way he moves around, I feel that you could put Leo up in front of any audience and they would get something out of
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
He's just very skilled at this. So I think he's going to go on to do really big things. And I thought everybody was good, but I just think Leo in particular, he just knows how to do this. He knows how to get up there and perform. And that's something that I guess some people learn or you're born with. And for him, that he has it, especially for someone who's never done this before.
Yeah, Jenkins just has some particular talent. You know, I guess probably he's just an extroverted guy. He always has been.
Yeah.
That's what I suspect anyway.
Definitely.
But, the tour is the Verses and Curses tour. So it's still going around for like a week around the East Coast. I read an excerpt from my memoir about an operation in Iraq that got a few laughs. I was glad people enjoyed it. It was a story about how we hit a target in Iraq, and our PL reported over the assault net, said, we've detained 6.5 men. And the company commander came over the net and was like, what the fuck do you mean 6.5 men? What's that mean? And the PL gets back over the net. He's like, we detained 6 men and 1 midget. and then he comes over the net. He's like, hold on, we're packing them out in a rucksack right now. And the company commander got fucking pissed and was like, leave the fucking midget. We don't fucking need him. So, I wrote about that. And that was the first, that was like kind of like the public premiere of the book. The first time I'd read anything from it or shared any of that stuff publicly. I'm excited to see how the rest of it comes out.
Yeah, Jim West read a really touching piece about
Jim. Man, it took Jim like 60 some odd years to get to that point that he was able to say some of that stuff. You know, yeah. I was proud of him.
Yeah, it was in particular. It was about kind of living with the horrors of war, living with PTSD, the nightmares.
Yeah. And well, for Jim, he went through combat and all that other stuff, rough upbringing as a kid. And then when his son was murdered, his would have been his older son. His younger son was there at the event yesterday. Terrific kid. But his older son was murdered by a drug dealer back in the 1990s. And when that happened, like, it crushed Jim. And he felt like he was being, like, the world was punishing him because he led this very violent life as, like, you know, as a street fighter, going out to bars and just mauling people all the time. All the stuff he did in combat, he felt like there was some sort of like retribution for the life he had lived, that his son had been killed, and that like, and so he lived with a lot of shame, and became ashamed even of his military service and all of the good things he did for a long time. And so I'm glad that he's kind of come out of his shell and he's able to talk about that stuff, and he's able to regain a sense of pride in his life and his accomplishments rather than just see it in a negative light.
Yeah. And that, by the way, this is my first time meeting his son, Richard. I would never think that's Jim West's son.
I knew him when he was in high school because Jim had introduced us.
That's right.
I can barely recognize a kid now because he's been going through military training and everything else. But I mean, he's a grown ass man now. He's a totally different guy.
But he's not the type of person you would think that gets into street fights.
No, he's
which is
not.
Funny,
he's
you know?
Not.
He's it's also funny because
he's a good kid.
He grew up around here, so I shouldn't think this, but I would think of Jim West's son having that Georgia accent, and he does not. He sounds like a regular person from the tri-state area. You know what's funny that he told me? So he just got done with Air Force training, and I think this is kind of interesting for, you know, there's always people who listen to the show who want to join the military, and he was pretty honest about saying that the physical attributes to get into the Air Force, he was like, it wasn't anything like overwhelming by any means.
No, of course not.
He works out with Jim, who really will put you through a workout.
Oh, yeah. He was sparring with his dad. Jim West will put you through the ringer.
Yeah, but according to him, joining the Air Force, and I mean, I wouldn't know. He was not that physically demanding.
It's true just to join the military. I think you have to take a physical. I don't think you even take a PT test. I mean, it was optional when I went in, and I took a, they were like, come take a PT test. And instead of going in as a private, you can go in as a PV2. And so I took some stupid PT test, did some push-ups, and they're like, oh, here you go. I don't think there is a PT requirement per se. I think you just have to be in good physical health.
There should be, though, right? Don't you think?
Well, the thought process behind it, I think, from the military's point of view, is like, that's what basic training is for. It's to, like, whip your ass into shape. So instead of having that gate there, it's kind of like, okay, by the end of basic training, you have to pass the PT test. But even then, I mean, passing a regular Army PT test is not that hard. I mean, you do, like, it's probably like just a pass is probably like 35 push-ups and like 40 sit-ups and run the 2 miles and, you know, 17 minutes or something like that. I mean, which is very slow.
Yeah.
I mean, don't quote me on that. You can go look at the APFT graduated scale for your age and see exactly what the numbers are. But, I mean, just passing a PT test is not like a big deal at all.
All right. Well, in other news, I definitely have to mention this. As we're here, Kim Jong-chol, the former head of North Korean military intelligence, is traveling to New York City. Trump earlier today tweeted, "We have put a great team together for our talks with North Korea. Meetings are currently taking place concerning summit and more." Kim Jong-chol, the vice chairman of North Korea, heading now to New York. Solid response to my letter. Thank you. So this contrasts with our last episode where this meeting was called off. It looks like it's very likely to happen again. It's reality TV, man.
Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? Who's it going to be? Yeah. Who's going to win?
I wonder where Scholl is going to be, like where he's going. Are they going to meet at Trump Tower in New York City, or
there are meetings with North Koreans in New York because the UN is here.
But this is a pretty high profile guy.
They're making it high profile.
Yeah.
It's probably not the first time the guy met with American officials.
But we know about it.
But now they're tweeting about it. So
yeah. Yes. Would you think Trump Tower?
I would think not, because that's at his personal residence. I think he'd get into some trouble for that. So it'll probably be, you know, maybe at the UN or something.
Yeah, that's the other thing I was thinking. All right. Well, also, before we get to Daniel Ford, which I'm excited for, we have this email from Mike, which he originally sent an email before we had on. I'm losing my train of thought here. Before we had on Dan Gordon, and he was saying that he felt our comments on Israel, that we'd gotten the story a little bit wrong. And I emailed him back and I said, I think you'll like the next episode with Dan Gordon. I'm tired right now. So Dan Gordon, I'm going to sleep after this podcast. I'm running off very little sleep right now. So I apologize, guys. So this is an email from Mike. Guys, the episode with Dan Gordon was one of the best ever. That was fantastic and straight up insight into the current situation in Gaza. Thanks for getting the real story out to your listeners. I have friends serving there now, and they confirmed that they didn't shoot anyone until they got within 100 meters of the border fence, and then they only shot below the knees. Jack, you mentioned wanting to come here to Israel to do some coverage of the situation. If you or Ian decide to take a trip out there, I would love to host you guys for a weekend in the West Bank. We have a large American-sized house with guest room, top-end scotch, and I would love to give you a tour of the area and some insights into the current geopolitical situation here. I can also put you in touch with others who are more in the know of the military and political side of things. So please take me up on the offer. My family and I would love to host and provide you guys with some real Texas-style hospitality in the other Lone Star State. Semper Fi, Mike Ekstut. So probably pronouncing that wrong, but appreciate it. So I guess a former Marine living in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I'd take him up on that.
I have his email address and phone number.
If you think about it, like how much news coverage have we really seen of like people doing like embedded reporting with the IDF?
Not a whole lot.
Yeah, not a whole lot. It would be interesting.
Yeah, I agree. So keep sending the emails to softrep.radio@softrep.com. With that, joining us for the first time, Daniel Ford, author of Cowboy, the Interpreter Who Became a Soldier and a Warlord, and One More Casualty of Our War in Vietnam. It actually just came out last month, so it's available now. Order it. Daniel's book was actually mentioned to us by Vietnam Green Beret Jim Morris on episode 346, and Daniel reached out to me and was like, hey, I'm the author of that book, and figured we'd have you on because it's a great story. The book is the firsthand account of what went on, because Daniel was actually embedded himself with forces in Saigon in 1964, and you're a U.S. Army vet and reporter in Vietnam. I was looking at your website. You've written dozens of books about all different types of conflicts worldwide. So honored to have you on, sir.
I'm glad to be here. And it's, as you say, it's Cowboy's second appearance on your program.
Yep.
Hey, Daniel, this is Jack. Thank you so much for coming on today. You know, I just wanted to say that, you know, it's great to have you on to talk about this gentleman. As I've said before, a lot of the interpreters that work with the U.S. military are kind of the unsung heroes of these conflicts. I know it's true for Vietnam, and it was true when I was in Iraq as well. So I'm really hoping, you know, that you can illuminate our listeners about who he was and what he did.
Cowboy, of course, was a lot more than an interpreter, almost from the beginning. He was hired on at Bo Na Nau, which is near Ban My Thuit, which was his hometown. And that was the first, that was the beginning of the strike force companies. He was created by the CIA. Before Special Forces came under Army control. And there was an international voluntary service worker, Dave Nuttall, who apparently came up with the idea and sold it to Gilbert Layton and William Colby of the CIA in Saigon. And he's the man who hired Cowboy as a truck driver. He agrees that Cowboy immediately became very helpful to there were several Green Berets assigned to the camp. This would have been in the fall of 1961.
Early on.
That was the first one. And it was very different from what it was when Jim Morris came along 3 years later. The idea was village defense.
Strategic hamletting, right?
It was an alternative to the strategic hamlet. You took an existing highland village. In the case of Bo Na Nau, it was Rade. And most of the early ones were Rade camps. And the idea was to spread around an ever-growing radius so that you wound up with village defenders who were volunteers and a mobile strike force company and eventually a battalion covering a dozen or more camps or villages. And it was only when the Army took over in what they called Operation Switchback, though it wasn't switching back at all, it was switching over, that the strikers became a mobile force operating out of a set area. And gradually they became dispersed on the frontier of Cambodia and Laos. And we used to intercept, but that was not how it began. I don't know what happened to Cowboy after Bo Na Nau began its transition. Dave Nuttall quit and went home in 1962 after a year setting it up. And many of the villages were turned over to the province chief in Ban My Thuit. And Cowboy, meanwhile, had married Dave Nettles' ex-wife, as it happens, and adopted took over his daughter. And I suspected, and she was a Jirai and lived in Chirio, a bit to the north. There are three major population centers in the highlands, from north to south, Pleiku and Chirio and Bami Tuit. Jirai and Rade both were matrilineal tribes. So when you married, you went to live with your wife's family. Dave Nuttall didn't do that. But Cowboy may have done, moved up to near Chirio and got hired on by his own account at the Boon Bing camp, the one where Jim Morris later served. But apparently he got fired, and he got fired a lot, actually. And he claimed that he was the battalion commander, which seemed very unlikely, because the camp was Jirai, and he was a Rade, and he was very young, 25, 26. But in any event, he wound up a little farther north near Pleiku at Duck Co. And the first Green Beret who wrote about him was Captain Johnny Corns, who took over the Duck Co. camp between Pleiku and the Cambodian border in 1963, August. And Cowboy was already installed there, was already called the Cowboy, and had already adapted his swagger and his line of talk, which he apparently got out of John Wayne movies. He said, sorry, don't get it done, dude, and so on. However, he's not living with his wife and daughter, so he moved down to Boon Bing, and Cruz McCullough, who was the commander of that A team, 424, I think it was, Jim Morris's team, hired him on in December 1963. And both these men, Johnny Corns and Cruz McCullough, agreed that Cowboy was one of the most natural soldiers I'd ever encountered. And that was my own impression of him. I mean, I was never in combat, so I don't pretend to know a great deal about it. But he struck me as the man most comfortable in his skin, in cami fatigues and a bush hat, and carrying his carbine or M16 or AR-15, whatever it was. He just seemed natural at that work. And I was keeping I came in there in June of 1964, and I kept a journal. I would type it up every couple of nights. And when I got to Boon Bing, I wrote the Jirai, that is the tribesman who lived around Chirio, looked just like the Montagnards I met in Pleiku, sturdy, dark, and coarse-featured. The only handsome man in the group is the interpreter, whose name is Philippe Drouin, but whom the Americans call Cowboy. He cuts a dashing figure in an expensive, broad-brimmed camouflage hat. Actually, they weren't all that expensive. I think I paid $3 for mine, tailor-made in Saigon, and tiger-striped camouflage fatigues. He carries a hunting knife strapped to his waist. He earned his nickname from his habit of demonstrating his fast draw with his knife, using Viet Cong prisoners as his audience and target. Supposedly, he has killed 22 men with that knife, smiling his brilliant smile. "You've got to take the bad with the good," sighed the team's executive officer, Captain Walter Swain of Miami, "and Cowboy is a good interpreter." I don't know who told me that he'd killed 22 men. I've also seen the figure 15. And I don't know how much truth is in it, but that's what I wrote down when I met him.
So, I mean, he was a pretty extraordinary character by the time you got there in 64.
He was, and he became more so, of course. And I was astounded that people who were never near the Highlands knew about him. I talked to her email, I don't remember which, a Special Forces officer, Carter, I think his name was, who lived way up, who was stationed way up by the 17th parallel. And he knew all about this. And this was after Cowboy was killed, and way outside his area of operation. So he was well known, apparently.
And Cowboy was working with A-teams at this point.
Yes, apparently starting as early as early 1963, maybe even late 62.
Which makes sense. And I mean, that's about when Jim Morris got there.
64.
Yeah.
Well, actually, he came in December 63.
Right.
And that was when Cowboy was hired, apparently shortly after they arrived.
So what are some of the other adventures or misadventures that that Cowboy got into working with U.S. Special Forces in Vietnam?
Well, one of the things that impressed me, Johnny Korns wrote a book called Our Time in Vietnam. And he tells how that was, and as I said, they were still under CIA at that time. And once a month, the agent would fly in with a basket of piastres for the payroll and pay off the men. One time he brought in a Leica camera and gave it to Captain Korns and apparently told him to slip across into Cambodia and photograph an airstrip that had been recently built. And they set off, and on their way they were ambushed. And as Captain Korns tell the story, Cowboy sees the BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle, from the man who was carrying it, you know, fired it from the hip, silenced the ambush, and set the whole thing straight. And as they got towards the border, he took the camera from Captain Korns and apparently picked out the men he wanted and went across the frontier and came back with the photographs that were needed.
Wow.
And you really get the impression that Cowboy was the man running that operation, that he just took over. And from what I saw of him, I believe that was possible.
Yeah, I mean, he was the guy who understood the language, the terrain, the culture. I mean, Americans would kind of be lost without that kind of local knowledge backing them up, I would think.
Jim Morris wrote in War Story that the madness of their six-month deployment, where, as he said, you spend 2 months getting your feet on the ground. No, he said 4 months, and then 2 months of actually doing something.
Yeah.
I sort of figured it was probably two months getting ready and 2 months operating at full bore and maybe 2 months thinking of you back at your family in Okinawa. Because most of these men were married and had children. So they would think of home. But it was a crazy system, really. Even a year seemed little. The CIA, to its credit, did stick around for a while. I think William Colby was in Saigon 3 years. So they had a little more institutional memory than the Army did.
And what ended up happening to Cowboy? I mean, right now we're still talking about pretty early on in the war. What happened after Jim Morris left? Did he stay and continue to work with Special Forces?
He was working with several sides, apparently. I didn't know about this at the time, but in August 64, there was a uprising of mm-hmm. Highlanders, and several camps were overrun or seized by the strikers, and in some cases the Vietnamese cadre were killed, and in one case the Americans were held hostage. And Cowboy apparently was deeply involved in all this. And after it was over, and there was some compromise between the general in Saigon and the rebellious Highlanders, some compromise offers were made. And there was a meeting at Camp Holloway in Pleiku. Camp Holloway was also where the Special Forces B team was located. And Jerry Hickey, who was a civilian anthropologist working for RAND Corporation and indirectly for the Department of Defense, who had been in Vietnam for years, went to that meeting and he said that Cowboy, Philip, was one of the delegates there, and that the delegates wore jackets and ties, which really amazed me. I could easily picture him in camis, but in a jacket and tie seemed a bit of a stretch. And one of the few concessions that the Saigon government honored, the promises that they made, was that Highlanders would be allowed to become aspirants in the ARVN, the Army of South Vietnam, an aspirant being a French grade of a sub-lieutenant or cadet officer.
Interesting.
And Cowboy apparently became one of those. But as the story is told, he was never paid, which was always a hazard if he was serving in the Vietnamese Army. So he deserted, and he went to the Mike Force in Nha Trang and became an interpreter there. And what happened to him after that, I'm not sure. By the time Jim Morris came back, that would be in 67, Cowboy apparently had recruited his own division, which sounds more like a regiment, and with a training center somewhere east of Bamituat, towards the sea. And there's a great sequence in Jim Morris's war story about the two of them getting into a jeep and heading out to inspect this, the Dam E Division, it's called, of Commando Paratroop. And Jim was very impressed by the soldiers there. But when they left the populated part of Bamituat, he mentions racking a cartridge into the chamber of his M16 and Cowboy looking over at him and grinning. And the implication being that there's always a possibility this is a setup and he's being sold out to the North Vietnamese. And we're so professional that one of us could kill the other and not have no regrets. And in all of this, you don't really get a sense of where this commando unit is located, but it's somewhere east of Bamiatua, and has about 3,000 men on board. And apparently, a cowboy rented out these battalions to anyone who needed them. I don't know if this included the North Vietnamese, but probably not. But there was always that possibility. And he eventually got into so much trouble playing all sides, U.S. Army, perhaps the French intelligence, perhaps the North Vietnamese, that he became hunted by his own side. And he, in the end, was ambushed. And it didn't work out as easily. It never does, apparently. He was going to be taken down while he was at dinner. And he escaped out the back and fled out to a Mike Force unit, which apparently, where apparently most of the men were his own soldiers, and scarfed up a lot of weaponry, and 2 deuce-and-a-half trucks and a 3/4-ton truck to carry the stuff off with. But was eventually captured by his own side, by the full row Highland rebels, and executed in January of 1968, just before the Tet Offensive. And that was the end of Cowboy.
It's pretty incredible. I mean, so he, I mean, as it says in the byline of your book, I mean, he basically did install himself as a warlord and created a mercenary army in South Vietnam.
Jim Morris mentions that he was told he when he went back, he wanted, of course, to command an A-team, but as an upcoming major, a rising captain, he was stuck in the B team in Pleiku, and he was told to open up a camp, may have been an abandoned camp, near the Cambodian border, and he simply asked Cowboy to produce the men, which Cowboy did, and they were all obviously, to a trained eye, experienced soldiers, although they were wearing loincloths and cast-off uniforms. So that may have been his outfit. And as the story is told, he was like a executive headhunter. He charged 3 months' salary or something like this. Of your first 3 months' salary, you rebated to Cowboy.
He was an entrepreneurial-minded person.
And of all of these, apparently 10% of their salary of the Highlanders in these strike forces was supposed to go back to Fulro to support their aspirations for independence. And he may have kept a lot of that back, and that may have been why they put the figure on him at the end.
That's a fascinating story. And I mean, it seems like all too often, this is what ends up happening to our allies and the people who help us out is, they end up getting killed by their own people.
Well, or simply left behind, as happened to many of these full row fighters. They kept on fighting, after 1975. The Highlanders were always badly treated by the Vietnamese. The saying of Vietnam is that it's like a peasant carrying 2 baskets of rice on a long, thin pole. One basket is the Red River Delta in the north, and the other basket is the Mekong River Delta in the south. And the pole is the shoreline of Vietnam, which is where the ethnic Vietnamese settled. And the highlanders were the Aboriginal inhabitants. They were there for thousands of years. And were regarded as savages. They were better treated by the French and by the Americans, which is why they were so loyal to the foreigners as opposed to the people in Saigon. And the North Vietnamese, of course, were no better or worse. Dave Nettle tells a story of how his wife and daughter were treated in April of 1975 when the North Vietnamese police, or now the Vietnamese police, came to their home and beat Arcom Hun to death and injured the daughter sufficiently but she did recover in time.
Good Lord.
And came to the United States in time. But a lot of the fighters wound up in Cambodia as recently as the 90s, and many were eventually repatriated to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I should have asked Jim Morris, and I mean, we'll have to have him back on again at some point. But some of the former Special Forces soldiers and presumably others as well played a pretty big role in, having some of these, the people who helped us in Vietnam from the Central Highlands and helping them immigrate to the United States, if I remember correctly.
A lot of Americans got hooked on Vietnam. Jim Morris was one. Mike Bing in Mammy Tuit was another. He was captured at Tet. He was a civilian. Started out with the International Voluntary Service and wound up working for USAID. He spent 6 years in captivity. Was flown out in 1975 when the prisoners were brought home. Even when he was recovering, he went back to Vietnam to work with them. The special forces did work closely with bringing those refugees, the Montagnard fighters, back. After 27 years of war.
And so this is your latest book, Daniel. Just for people who are interested in picking it up, it's called Cowboy, The Interpreter Who Became a Soldier, a Warlord, and One More Casualty of Our War in Vietnam. We have a copy here. I'm going to actually take this home and read it. I'm sorry I haven't gotten to it before the interview. But this is really cool, and I'm really glad that you put some time into this and telling Cowboy's story.
If you go to Dan's website, as I mentioned during the intro, there's tons of other books Dan has written. I mean, there's dozens of books you've written on foreign conflicts and have just an extensive background.
You wrote a book about John Boyd. That's really cool.
Yeah, so for the listeners, make sure you go to danfordbooks.com. And this book in particular just came out last month, so it's available Kindle or paperback on Amazon.
Thank you both.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Dan.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Daniel.
Great having Daniel Ford on once again. DanFordBooks.com. Cowboy is available now. And as always, there's only one club out there with gear handpicked by Special Operations military veterans from several branches, and that, of course, is Crate Club. Past items we've had in our crates have been Emerson knives, a Blackhawk industrial medical pouch, and cool stuff like a custom playing card set with exclusive photo shoot pictures we did of models with guns. We have different tiers of membership, depending on how prepared you want to be, and gift options are available as well. You can check that all out at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us. For you dog owners, check this out. You're going to love this. We've just partnered with Kuna. They have a team of trained canine handlers picking out a box for your dog each month of healthy treats and training aids. It's custom built for your dog's size and age as well. The products are U.S. sourced, all natural, and not only promote a healthy diet, but also promote being active with your dog. So whether we're talking a pit bull or a chihuahua, this is just what you're looking for. You can see all of that at kuna.dog. That's kuna.dog. It's efficient for you, and your dog will appreciate it as well, of course. That's spelled CUNA.DOG. If you check out the Instagram, many people on the staff have dogs enjoying their boxes, like Nick Betts's dog, and I even saw Nick Kaufman gave a box to his dog. A lot of guys on the side of dogs. I need to get a dog.
My dog is old as shit. He's 17 years old.
I met your dog.
He doesn't give a shit about anything. He sleeps wherever.
Yeah.
Comes right next to you while you're working, lays down on the floor and just farts for hours.
I do miss having a dog. It's been many years for me. Well, also as a reminder for all of those listening, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premier show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership. It's only $4.99 a month. And you can check out the app as well, the Spec Ops channel app. We appreciate you guys listening. As always, next episode, I have a special to air of different fiction authors we've had in studio, from Tony Tata to Anderson Harp and Brad Thor. So
enjoy. I have a few more in mind to get on in the future.
I'm excited for it, man. We got to get more in studio people because it has been a while other than Paul Shari. And we have the new studio here. So I'd like to get some more people who can come in. We're in like the media capital of the world. So, I don't know if it's just been light on like military books right now, because usually there's a lot of people who want to come in here and are going to be touring the area, you know, with big books out. But not as many lately. But, you know, every week we do get multiple people on, but we got to get some people here in New York. All right. Well, enjoy, guys. Hope you enjoyed your Memorial Day weekend once again. And for those who, you know, lost family members or friends in combat, I hope you honored their service to our country and the people that you love. We'll see you guys soon. And like I said, next episode, special fiction authors episode. Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. For all of the great content from our veteran journalists, join us and become a Team Room member today at softrep.com. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio. And be sure to also check out the Power of Thought podcast, hosted by Hurricane Group CEO and Navy SEAL sniper instructor, Brandon Webb.